entire planet. Yes, please. Thank you very much.
Already planet buying is exciting, but could it be something else?
Maybe I'm just too invested in the solar system having a pet black hole.
Is it planet nine? Hello, welcome to the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark, and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
Yep, and I'm very excited for this month's episode. We've made it, Izzy. Finally, this month, it's all about the mysterious planet nine.
Yes.
This mysterious and so far undetected hypothetical ninth planet in our solar system. But is it a planet? Is it a black hole? Is it even real? The big questions for this one.
Yeah, just taking the big questions head on. So we'll be speaking with the scientists researching Planet Nine to try and get to the bottom of all of this. And Robert Massey is here too, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society. So Robert, where do you stand on this? Planet, black hole, does it exist?
We don't know if it exists. I'm kind of in the category of I want to believe. I'd really love there to be a planet out there, let alone a black hole. I mean, that'd be incredible. It's worth reflecting that it's not the first time that we've talked about a planet at the edge of the solar system. And if you think historically, Neptune was the expansion of the solar system after the discovery of Uranus, and then Pluto when that was a planet. And when Pluto was, before it was officially downgraded, we realized it was a lot smaller than initially thought. In the 1970s, we found a moon around it, and that meant it was a lot smaller. And so then people started looking for what was then Planet X at that time, because Pluto was still a planet. So they had Planet X, Roman numeral X, for the 10th planet. And that discovery, that quest anyway, went on into the 1980s until it was ruled out. So it does come around periodically. So I have a degree of skepticism about it, but you know, there's serious work going on to look for it. So maybe it's there. It is probably quite hard to see. It could be in front of the stars, the Milky Way, and that would make it pretty difficult to detect. But there are lots of surveys to look through. So maybe it's sitting there in the data, or maybe when the Webb telescope's launched, we'll detect its infrared signature. So it's exciting. I'd love there to be that planet, or let alone black hole, sitting out on the edge of our solar system.
I'm Becky. I think I know the answer to this one, but where do you sit on this one?
I'm on team black hole. It's a black hole. I'm
convinced.
Yeah, obviously. The evidence is so convincing. It wouldn't be the first time that we'd mathematically predicted the existence of a planet, because that's what we did with Neptune. So yeah, okay, it's good to understand the history that this comes around quite often, but I think sort of the evidence is starting to pile up a bit more in its favor at the minute. That's the sort of camp I currently sit in, but maybe I'm just too invested in the solar system having a pet black hole.
There is that. I mean, I'm personally like, giant planet, yes please, thank you very much.
Yeah. Anyway, cheers Robert, we'll catch up with you later in the podcast to take on our listener questions.
So last month, we explored the Kuiper Belt at the far edge of our solar system. But some objects, the most distant, the ones on the most elongated orbit, caught the attention of astronomers Mike Brown and Constantine Batygin from the California Institute of Technology. The objects were bunched together and unusually all pointed in the same direction. So in 2016, Mike and Constantine made headlines worldwide when they suggested that the only explanation for this could be that the gravity of Planet Nine, a giant planet way out beyond Neptune, had nudged them together. I spoke to Mike, who explained how they came to this conclusion.
This conclusion has been jumped to 35 times in the past, and all 35 times it's been wrong. The first thing we wanted to do is absolutely not say that it was a planet. So we tried everything else we could think of. We thought about perturbations from a nearby star. We thought about the collective gravity of the Milky Way galaxy, gravity of all the bodies put together. We tried every other thing we could come up with. And after about a year of really hard work failing, our failure was that it has to be a planet. There really is no other viable explanation for these gravitational perturbations we're seeing than that there is a giant planet also on a very distant elongated orbit out there.
Okay, so then let's talk about possible sizes and what this planet would look like. How can you even put that together?
Yeah, so putting the mass together really was about a 3-year effort. Just finished doing the analysis of, and it was hundreds of these computer simulations that we then compare to what we see in the outer solar system. And so we come up with that it's about 6 times the mass of the Earth. We even get an uncertainty. The range is between about 5 times the mass and about 8 times the mass of the Earth, with 6 being the most likely.
It's quite big. I mean, it's what, like the fifth largest planet in our solar system?
Certainly the fifth most massive. Well, it's certainly the fifth largest planet in our solar system. The next question, of course, I tell you the mass, because the mass is what we know, but you're about to ask me how big it is. And again, can't tell you that I know the answer to that question, because I only can tell you how massive it is. And I don't know what kind of planet it is. You can imagine that there's a big difference between, you know, something that's like the Earth, but 6 times more massive. So a super Earth versus something that's like Neptune, which is, Neptune is 17 times the mass of the Earth. So imagine something that's like Neptune, but a little smaller. And those two would be very different sizes. A rocky Earth thing would be kind of small comparatively versus a puffy gas thing would be quite large. So we don't know. But again, I think we know enough from looking around the rest of our galaxy to be able to make sensible predictions. When we see planets that are something like 6 times the mass of the Earth, when we see them throughout our galaxy, they tend to be more like miniature versions of Neptune than like large versions of the Earth.
Okay. And then, so what about the orbit? How far out is this?
It's pretty far out there. In this whole analysis that we did, closest it ever comes to the sun is 200 astronomical units. Astronomical unit is distance from the Earth to the sun, so 10 times further than Neptune. The furthest it ever goes might be something like 20 or 30 times Neptune, 600 AU, 800 AU. It's way the heck out there on a nicely eccentric orbit and tilted. An orbit like that probably takes somewhere of the order of 10,000 years to go around the sun. Depends exactly on how far away it is, but let's just call it 10,000 years.
How could something this far out still be tethered to our sun at such large distances?
Yeah, so it seems like a large distance to us, but the sun's gravitational influence extends much, much further. So if Planet 9 is at something like, let's say, 500 AU, it could be 10 times further away. It could almost be 50 times further away, and it would still be bound to the sun, as opposed to either flying through the galaxy or being captured by another star.
Where would it have come from? We've got this planet out there. Tell me.
Yeah. So I'll first admit that we don't know the answer to that. And the reason we don't know the answer to that is because the theory of Planet 9 really is based on its gravitational pull. So all we know is how much gravity it has. We know how massive it is. And what we know is that it's something like 6 times more massive than the Earth. But we don't know, the theory doesn't say anything about how it got there. Nonetheless, as astronomers are good at doing, we can make up stories to explain something. So the story I would tell you is that it probably formed in the same region as Uranus or Neptune early on. And in the early part of the solar system, there was a lot of there are a lot of things close by, a lot of interaction between planets, and Planet 9 probably got a little bit too close to Jupiter or Saturn, and it got flung outward, and it's been lurking at the edge of the solar system ever since then. That said, again, we don't know that's the answer, and there are at least 2 other ideas that people have come up with. One is that it just formed out there, and we traditionally don't think it's possible to form things that far away. The third one, I like the idea, even though I think the probability is small, is that we stole it. Is that it used to be a planet around another star. That star came swinging by the Earth. We nabbed Planet 9 and the star kept on going. It's not impossible. It's a little hard to make it happen, but it's not impossible. And one of the fun things is that once we find Planet 9 and start to study it and see what it's really like, we'll probably start to be able to answer these other questions of how the heck did it get there.
Okay, so that leads me on to the big question of how do we find Planet 9? What's that next step?
We now know where to look. In this new analysis that we just completed, and it's going to hit your local astronomical journal sometime relatively soon, in it, there's what we call the treasure map. The treasure map basically says, look here. So there's a band in the sky. It goes kind of halfway between Orion and Taurus and up through Gemini and then keeps on going around the other side. That's where to look. So we have a range of predictions of brightness, for example. And that's going to require some dedicated telescopic searches, which we're right now we're doing at the Subaru telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii. Is a big telescope, 8-meter telescope, with the largest camera on a big telescope in the world. So I am very optimistic that it's going to be found by, you know, I'll say, I hope us, but also this treasure map, we just did what pirates never do. We published it free to anybody to look at. So anybody who wants to go join in the search, they should go look too. And I will be sad when someone else finds it, but I'll also be happy when someone else finds it.
Okay. And I don't mean to rock the boat here, but what do you say?
It's what pirates do. It's true.
I am a pirate. I don't know if you've noticed. What do you think of those who are saying that this could be a black hole?
So again, as I said before, it is something like 6 times the mass of the Earth. And that's all I know for sure. So it could be anything that's 6 times the mass of the Earth. It could be a planet. It could be a 6 Earth mass black hole. It could be a 6 Earth mass hamburger, burrito, maybe more likely. We can't tell you for sure because we haven't seen it. We see planets like it throughout the galaxy, even at distances like that. We see that a lot of stars have planets that far away. So it's a perfectly normal, not exotic explanation. Is it possible? I mean, it's not impossible, but is it true? No, they're planets. Planets, we know that there are planets like that. They're all planets. There's not a black hole among them. Is it impossible that it's a giant burrito? Okay, maybe, but still, it's not a black hole.
Safe to say, I am really hoping that it is just a giant burrito.
I know, I'm really torn now, like my two loves, black holes or Mexican food. I'm not entirely sure which one to go for now.
But another thing that I found really interesting from Mike, that he was telling me about, you know, the things that could make Planet Nine exist or what potentially explained it, was that they looked at these objects, the ones pointing in this certain direction, and they said that based on the characteristics of Planet Nine, Planet Nine should cause their orbit to twist and essentially go through the vertical plane. And they predicted that should exist and they just couldn't find it. And then they realized, oh, actually, no, we're not looking at this quite right. And then found these really odd vertical orbits. So, you know, that's something that they didn't set out to find, but then did. And that sort of backed up their Planet Nine theory. So for me, I'm just like, oh, I really want it to be a planet. But Becky, you know, speaking of orbits, people have often looked at Neptune's orbit, and that's a lot more circular than other planets, which have a more of an ellipse orbit. So if there is a Planet Nine, could that be the reason?
Yeah, I mean, even after the discovery of Uranus and then Neptune in 1846, you know, people were already wondering if there was yet another planet beyond Neptune. I think because, you know, two had been discovered in quick succession, as well, maybe there's more out there, but also because of their strange orbits as well, right? Neptune's very circular. It could be that it's pulled into that very circular orbit by something beyond it. And it had people very curious to say, okay, well, what is going on there with Neptune's orbit and with Uranus's orbit? And that's really what spurred the search, obviously, for Pluto, which we know was then discovered in the 1930s, but then we figured out that it wasn't big enough to actually cause this whole orbit skewing, let's call it. All the objects beyond the orbit of Neptune, so, you know, Pluto, Sedna, that was discovered by Mike in 2004, as well, who we just heard from, they're the trans-Neptunian objects, right? And they only make up like 2% of the Earth's mass compared to Neptune's 17 times the Earth mass, right? So all of those things together just aren't enough to explain Neptune's weird orbit, and plus the weird orbits of the things in the Kuiper Belt themselves, these weird ones that are all clustered together, Pluto's orbit, Sedna's orbit, everything. Sedna's orbit's especially very, very strange as well. It's very elliptical, like way, way elliptical, but it's too far away from Neptune for Neptune to have any influence on it. So it's like, well, how did Sedna's orbit get so weirdly elliptical as well? So people have been speculating this for years, right? It's not just since 2016, since Mike and Constantine raised this idea. that there could be something out there. But I think because it's so recent and because this was the first paper that sort of said it would be this mass with this orbit in this place, and we could actually look for it and have a hope of doing it with current technology, or as Robert said before, maybe with the James Webb Space Telescope or something like that that's coming soon. I think that's why this has sort of brought it back to the forefront of people's minds a little bit. But this is not new. You know, people have been doing this for 150 years or so, 170 years, I guess. I keep thinking it's still it's still 2000. It's 2021, Becky. Add 20 years to all the rest of it.
And also, I feel like it's important for listeners to know that Mike Brown is also the reason that Pluto is no longer a planet.
Yep. So his handle on Twitter is Pluto Killer, which I love. And the reason is because Mike discovered Sedna back in 2004, but not just Sedna. A lot of other what we call trans-Neptunian objects that were about the same size as Pluto. And it was at that point people started realizing, well, if you're including Pluto in your list of planets, we're going to include all of these as well. And all of a sudden, the number of planets in the solar system is going to go from like 9 to 29, you know? So that was the decision that had to be made. And Mike was one of the people pitching this to the International Astronomical Union, that eventually there's sort of a panel made the definition for what a planet actually is, right? And Pluto and Sedna and all these others didn't come under that definition of the planet they came up with. And so Pluto killer.
And there's another thing here that Mike glossed over, and literally there was just too much to cover, mind-blowing things to cover, that I was like, I'm just going to park that over there. Is this idea that planets can be captured? I mean, is that something that is common? Talk us through how that would essentially work.
So we don't really know whether it's, you know, happens a lot or how common this actually is. It's not something we've ever been able to observe directly, right? Because it's not something we've ever got a heads up of happening before, and it takes a long, long time for this to happen. So instead, we're relying on our simulations that we have of how planets form, right? So the things we have of how does a solar system form from all the rubble that's left over? How do those things clump together to form planets? But also, how do they interact as they whiz around their sun or their star or something like that? And those interactions can cause sort of slingshots and sending bits of rubble just out of the solar system as it's forming, or out of whatever star system, you know, is forming as well. But, and then what we actually call those planets is rogue planets or free floating planets, FFPs. I personally prefer rogue planets because I think it makes them sound like pirates. Like, yes. Just pirates roaming around space, like, arr. Like rogue planets. They've got rogue.
Why are space pirates coming up so often in
the problem with these rogue planets, though, is if they're not near a star, right, they're nigh on impossible to see because there's no reflected light that we can actually like detect them, right? So we actually think this is what Oumuamua was, this strange cigar-shaped asteroid lump of rock that sort of whizzed through the solar system, looped around the sun and went back out again, right? We think this was a rogue object. And who's to say that if it didn't come in at a different angle, maybe, or a different speed, that could have been captured by the sun, and it could have ended up on an orbit like a comet, right, with a really, really long elliptical orbit that takes it way, way out. So it's definitely possible, we think, and then we think the most likely place this actually happens is when you have like a big star cluster, so lots and lots of stars that have all formed in one place, so they're a lot denser, they're a lot closer together. So if you did have one of these rogue planets got flung out, there's just a higher likelihood that it would encounter another star and therefore get captured as well, because, you know, the problem with the sun capturing something is that space is really big. Yes. And there's just so many places that a rogue planet could go, right? But at the same time, solar system's been around for 4.5 billion years. You wait long enough, one might come along, and, you know, you could be that some of the asteroids and comets in our solar system could be captured from another, you know, captured piece of rubble that's come from the formation of another star system. So that's the case for Planet Nine being a planet. But let me bring to the table now the most clickbaity science paper that I've ever seen, which I'll admit, it worked. I have never clicked on anything faster than I clicked on this paper. In 2019, Jakob Scholz and James Unwin published a paper titled, What if Planet Nine is a Primordial Black hole. I've honestly never been more excited when I read a title. It sent my black hole loving heart aflutter. And we've actually got Jakob with us now. He joins us here. Thank you so much for joining us, Jakob. When did you actually start exploring the idea that Planet Nine could actually be a black hole?
I think it started in 2018 when James's wife was pregnant at that time, and they used to go for these walks, and they ended up in the Chicago Planetarium, and James has seen this short, I think it was like a 15-minute movie about Planet Nine actually being a possibility. And I think he mentioned that he called me the next day thinking like, wow, this is kind of crazy, but what if it's not a planet? Like, what else could it be? Like, could it be something, you know, already Planet Nine is exciting, but could it be something else? And then we saw this paper that was in 2019 already. This paper already talked about this microlensing signal with primordial black holes that were actually the same size, same mass as this Planet Nine. And that's when it clicked, right? We have two anomalies that are otherwise unconnected except for the exact same mass scale. And so that's how it really started, I guess.
Okay, so two questions there. If we want to start with one, so what is that microlensing like? Can you describe that for me a little bit? And then also primordial black hole.
Right. So let's see. Microlensing, that is actually a really fantastic process where if you have a massive object, it bends light. And what can happen if this object gets between you and another star, it bends the light that normally would sort of pass wide by you, this light gets actually bent directly into your telescope. So for a little while, when this object is passing directly in front, you actually see more light coming from the star. The star appears to brighten for a little short amount of time. It can be actually a day or, you know, week. But so this is actually something that's being looked for. There is a bunch of experiments that look at monitor billions of stars in a real-time basis, and they check if they didn't happen to brighten in a fairly specific way for a short period of time. This is what microlensing is. And as for primordial black holes, those are hypothetical objects. These are black holes that are not formed by a collapse of a regular star. They're actually formed in the early universe, where already the universe is kind of born, or something causes overdensities in the universe, and these densities are so large, I mean, large in how much overdense they are, not how big they are, that they, in fact, almost immediately collapse into black holes, right? They could be, you know, fractions of solar mass. They could be planetary mass. They could be, you know, 10 to 17 grams, which is kind of order of a mountain mass, right? Like a Mount Everest mass, right?
I think that's what I love about the paper and this whole idea that it could be a primordial black hole is not just, as you said, this coincidence of masses, but the fact that it almost explains why we haven't seen Planet Nine.
Yes.
Right, because we haven't detected anything infrared, UV, anything like that, have we?
No, we haven't. I mean, I think it would be fair to say that there is still a range of Planet Nine possibilities, I mean, where it is on its orbit, things like this, it still wouldn't have been detected even with our best efforts, because not the entire orbit has been explored, etc. But on the other hand, once you've, you know, seen a bunch, you kind of start thinking, and you haven't seen anything, you start thinking, why isn't there, right? And this is really kind of the fun explanation for this kind of behavior.
I can see like Becky nodding along furiously, like, yeah, we can't see it.
It's such a fun, like, you're right, it is almost a fun idea. I think just the idea of the solar system having like a pet black hole, that's how I think of it. Pet on the outside of the solar system.
So we touched on this briefly, but let's talk about the size. So it would have to be roughly 5 Earth masses. So that is really not very big for a black hole. So, you know, how big would that actually be, and where would that have come from?
A 5 Earth mass black hole is somewhere around 10 centimeters across, right? So this is a large grapefruit. I mean, it's not a small grapefruit, it's a large grapefruit, right?
We must make that distinction. It's a large grapefruit, not a small one.
Absolutely. Or like a... not a watermelon. If it was a 10 Earth masses, we're kind of getting to a watermelon-sized object, right? Yeah, it would be kind of amazing, right? That you have this tiny little thing, so massive, floating somewhere out there in the solar system and really far, right? I mean, we're talking 400 astronomical units, astronomical unit being the distance from Sun to Earth, right? Now, how would it get there? What's the likelihood of capturing a planet versus what's the likelihood of capturing this particular primordial black hole? And that likelihood, you know, and that's when we kind of set out to calculate in the paper, and when we got the answer, right, it looked like 1-to-1. 1-to-1 is crazy, right? It's sort of telling you, okay, if you thought it was okay to capture a planet 9 out of this free floating planet population, then it's just as fine to capture a primordial black hole, assuming you believe in primordial black hole evidence, right? And that's a big if.
Yeah, and I think this is what is so convincing about this argument. It's just everything just seems to fall into place a little bit. But
right.
I mean, obviously we can all be convinced by sort of like probabilities and likelihoods and everything, but really we would like to prove if it was there if we could, right? So is there a way that we can go about doing this, that we can actually prove and say, yes, there is Planet 9 and it is a black hole?
Now, the question is, how would we actually check it's a black hole? Option number one, really a much better option number one, is we determine where it is by gravitational effects, and then we really see nothing out there, right? That would really start heavily biasing you towards thinking this is at least not a planet, right? This is something exotic. And that's already a win scenario, no matter how, you know, that cookie really crumbles, right? Then you start, you send a satellite there, right? And the fun thing is, you know, we know Voyager, okay, it took it 50 years to get to 100 AU, you know, give or take, right? And this is 400 AU, but our technology is better. And so this could be a lifetime type of sort of discovery, right? Where, or at least maybe I can imagine living this long to actually see what happened, right? So that to me already is amazing, right? And then the other thing is you could do is, I think one of the interesting thing is because it's such a tiny object, things can get actually pretty close before they get, you know, as a result, the deflections that are possible without hitting the objects are rather strong, right? And so as a result, we could actually see some sort of asteroids pass by, get bent, and then the orbit gets bent and actually heat them up. We could actually observe the area with Vera Rubin telescope, and there were some claims that within a couple of years of running the Vera Rubin, you could actually tell, right? And that is already fantastic.
Thank you so much, Jakob, for joining us there. That was absolutely fascinating. That was Jakob Scholz from the University of Turin. This is the Supermassive Podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and with science journalist Izzy Clark.
This month, we're investigating what's lurking at the edges of our solar system. Is it Planet 9? And another investigation that we've been carrying out here on the Supermassive Podcast is the hunt for moon trees. Now, Robert, this is something that you've really been involved in. So these are seeds that have been around the moon and come back, and we're trying to work out where they are. Have you had any updates from anyone in the UK?
Well, we haven't found any first generation moon trees in the UK yet. We've had a few second generation offers. So we had one from Christian Schwarzer in Germany who said he was happy to send us a cutting. I looked into that and it actually requires a really complicated tree passport. So we might take him up on it, but we need to do a bit of paperwork. But we did have Natalie Loben, who runs an ecological consultancy, and she has an unexplained sequoia in Worcester. So she's looking into that for us. This is where we are with all these leads. And we also heard from Rosemary Ruser in the US, and she's the daughter of Stuart Ruser, who was the Apollo 14 astronaut who took the seeds around the moon, and she's now president of the Moon Trees Foundation. So she's looking into it for us as well. And what we really want to do on the back of this, if we possibly can, is get a cutting, or get even better, getting one of the seeds and planting a moon tree near the RAS. So there's some way to go with all that. But have we found any definitive first generation moon trees in the UK? Not yet. So, you know, if anybody's listening and anybody has any other ideas, please do keep on getting in touch with us.
Oh my God, that is so exciting.
It is so exciting. Are they all sequoias?
No, they were different species, I think. Some of them were sycamores and so on. So it's just, I think the problem with trees is you plant them, they're beautiful, you remember the ceremony, but quite often you don't put a plaque on a tree very often. It sully it really. So when these things are done as a commemorative act, it's sometimes difficult to track them down as you've got really good record keeping. But we are hoping that, you know, it's 50 years ago, plenty of people involved hopefully is still around, and they can tell us if they remember it. That's what we really want to know.
If anyone has any leads whatsoever, do get in touch with the podcast on Twitter at Royal Astrosoc or email podcast@ras.ac.uk. And back to Planet Nine. Safe to say, we have had a lot of questions. I've picked out a few here. Robert, let's start with this one from Cole Deep, who wants to know, can Planet Nine be the binary partner of the Sun, which got pushed out?
Well, probably not, Cole Deep. And the reason for that is that if that binary partner was even reasonably close to the Sun, as in, you know, closer than the nearest stars, it's almost inconceivable we wouldn't detect it. There was this nemesis hypothesis that was around about a decade ago, which is unfortunately now the source of various bits of pseudoscience. But the idea of that was that there was a brown dwarf star in a highly elongated orbit that was coming in and causing mass extinctions by throwing comets in towards the Sun. And that's pretty much effectively been ruled out. And also the new generation of telescopes we're getting, it would be unlikely that we wouldn't have found that. And a brown dwarf, after all, is sort of a substar, an intermediate category. So anything brighter, we'd almost certainly have found. And the telescopic searches, as far as I'm aware, they could have found anything the size of Saturn, out to 10,000 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun. So it's unlikely that anything like that is there. What could be the case, though, is that you had, say, some gravitational interaction in the formation of the solar system, whereby this Planet Nine, if it exists, was formed closer in and then was ejected further out. Now, that's possible. And that certainly happens with smaller objects like comets and asteroids. But star, binary star, no, it's very, very unlikely the Sun has a binary star.
Or at least a current one anyway, because back in 2018, there was a paper that came out that was doing this like concerted search effort for things that looked like the Sun, like they were the same age, the same chemical composition near us. And they did find four that were like possible candidates. And so if we did used to have a binary, but somehow that got disrupted, I remember reading something about Planet Nine that said it's actually 10 times more likely to have a captured planet if you have a binary. So maybe if that was in the past, then you could have made that situation of capturing Planet Nine a bit more likely.
Or even if there are four other Sun-like stars, maybe we were part of a quintuplets. Is that fair?
Yeah, could be. A quintuplets. I would love that. Five-star system. It'd be great.
Okay, and Becky, Natalie asks, am I right in thinking we still haven't been able to observe primordial black holes? If so, how do we know what to search for in terms of finding the Planet Nine black hole?
Yeah, you're right, Natalie. We haven't ever observed a black hole smaller than about 3 to 4-ish times the mass of the Sun. There's some contention there. But those are black holes that are made by supernova, right? So when a star dies and runs out of fuel, that's one mechanism we know that is actually able or is capable of crushing matter down to the densities that you would need to form a black hole, right? Literally, like, taking all the space out of an atom and just crushing it and crushing it and crushing it. But in theory, you could have a black hole of any mass, right? That limit of like 3 to 4 is set by, like, if you have a smaller star, you'll make a neutron star rather than a black hole, kind of thing. In theory, you could have a black hole of any mass you like. Like, I could take my phone, right, and crush it down to dense enough to become a black hole of a phone mass black hole, right? But, you know, my little noodle arms probably aren't strong enough to do that, right? You know, we don't know of any mechanism that can do that except for these black holes possibly forming in the early universe when the conditions were very different and you know, matter was able to get that dense by itself. But they'd be no different to any other black hole that we'd observe, right? So stellar mass black holes are fairly similar to supermass black holes that are millions of times the mass of the Sun. The only difference is that when material spirals around them and we can detect the fact that that starts to heat up and glow because it's being accelerated to these huge speeds, it's the energies of the radiation we get from that material that differ. So they're obviously much higher energy for supermassive black holes compared to stellar mass black holes. So it could be something similar. If some material does happen very close to this tennis ball, large grapefruit sized black hole, then, you know, we could see something like that. So, I mean, they wouldn't be that different. Finding it, obviously, we talked with Jakob about how we do that, and there are lots of different ways that you can do it and lots of very clever ways.
And hello to Bath Astronomers on Twitter, because they always support the podcast.
Hello.
But they've sent in a question, Robert. And they say, given that we can't prove Planet Nine doesn't exist, just that it's
yet,
just that it's increasingly unlikely, At what point do we give up searching and dedicate telescopes to more worthy pursuits like finding the first toenail exomoon?
See, I'm not, that's clearly directed at someone else that's on this me. Podcast. But I'm sure Becky would be delighted for us to find the first toenail exomoon. And I'm sure Izzy will like the space burrito sitting there. But to be serious, I guess the thing is, like, in most cases, what you're talking about here is mining things like survey data rather than absolutely dedicating lots of telescope time to this search. So it's sort of an incidental thing, like with the Vera Rubin Observatory or these kind of things where you look through a lot of your existing data set, or it's a survey telescope and you're looking for things like Planet Nine in that data set anyway. So I don't think we're missing out on massive other discoveries if we spend a bit of time looking for Planet Nine.
Yeah, I think you could only ever sort of say we've searched through this specific one, but new data sets come in all the time, right? But I don't think I'd ever like to draw a line under it, right? Can you imagine, you know, when you're like looking for something around your house and you're like, I can't find it. And someone goes, well, have you looked everywhere? And you're like, yeah, of course I have. And then they go look and then they find it. You know, like, I don't want to be the person that says we've looked, we've not found it, we've looked everywhere. And then, you know, the next generation of scientists come along and go, well, you didn't look hard enough, did you?
Oh, well, thank you so much to everyone that sent in those brilliant questions. And if you want to do the same, you can do so by emailing podcast@ras.ac.uk or tweet @RoyalAstroSoc. And as exciting as all of this has been, Becky, do we want to address the elephant in the room? I mean, what are the arguments for Planet Nine not existing?
Yeah, all right. Let's rein ourselves in a little bit here, right?
Only a little bit.
let's come at this from, you know, no bias for black holes here. Yeah. So first of all of these clustered orbits we've observed could just be down to what's called observational bias, that old gem that astronomers love. The idea that our catalogs could be incomplete, basically, you know, of what's out there in sort of trans-Neptunian objects. It could be that there's no clustering happening at all. It's just that we've only observed a tiny section of them that look to be all in the same place. And if we had, you know, better surveys and we could find more of them, we'd find that there'd be all these other ones that were, you know, filling out the sort of possibilities of what different types of orbits you could have out there. So that sort of old gem of small number statistics could just explain this all the way, really, which would be sad, I think. But there's also lots of other hypotheses to explain these sort of clustering orbits and strange things that are happening out there as well that aren't anything to do with Planet Nine too. So that could be anything from what's called a disk instability, so like you'd have some sort of warp in the disk that would send things funny. We see these in galaxies as well, and they make these bar structures, so it could be affecting like a solar system disk. You could also have another massive disk of rocky bodies way beyond the Kuiper belt, so the Kuiper belt being around 30 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun. This would be sort of about 100 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun. Maybe you've got something out there. Or you could have an even more massive planet even further out, which would be why we've not detected anything further in, perhaps something like that. And I think there's lots and lots of different ideas, and all of those are sort of considered when people write scientific papers about these, but they're possibly left out of like a media write-up for in favor of the more exciting Planet Nine idea, right? Because planet there being an extra planet is way more exciting than like, oh, the solar system disk has had a little wobble and everything's fine. Like, you know, so.
Yeah, okay, well, at least we've covered it, but on my point of view, fingers crossed for a planet. How about some stargazing for this month, Robert? What can we see?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's summer, right? So UK astronomy is curtailed by short nights, and the sun's never that far below the horizon, so it doesn't actually get properly dark, intriguingly, in the UK until late July. If you look at particularly in the north of Scotland, you see this sort of simmer dim, as they call it in the Shetlands, where there's twilight all night. But there are quite a few things you can see, and in the night sky you can see something called noctilucent clouds, which are a sort of weird faint high up system of clouds right up in the mesosphere, so above the stratosphere, and they're illuminated by the sun not being that far below the horizon, but they're super high, 75-80 kilometers up. And if you see them, they're weirdly ethereal because it's basically night and you see this odd display in the sky. And I saw them for the first time last year when I was out taking pictures of Comet Nearwise. And I thought, I've got to see some of these things again. They're absolutely beautiful. So do take a look for those and tweet us, send your pictures to us. We'd love to see that. But the big thing I'm looking forward to in the coming weeks is a solar eclipse. So this is the first one that will be visible from the UK for some years, I think since 2017. That wasn't very good. And so on the 10th of June in the morning from about 10:15 to about 20 past 12, depending on exactly where you are in the UK, you will see between about a fifth and two-fifths of the sun blocked out by the moon here. Now, if you're lucky enough to be up in the Canadian Arctic, the Arctic Ocean, or Siberia, which I'm guessing is a small subset of the people listening to this.
I mean, we have quite a wide listenership. I'm not sure if it's that one.
Could be one. You know, all the Ontarians out there.
Exactly. But if you're in that little path, it's part of what's called an annular eclipse, where the moon moves directly in front of the sun but doesn't quite cover it. So you get a sort of a bright ring left around it. Anyway, for the UK, it's a prospect of seeing a solar eclipse. The thing I always have to stress when I talk about these things is that, yes, the sun's nice and high in the sky. Obviously, you need clear skies to see it. But if you do have those clear skies, then be safe. Don't sit and stare at the sun. You can really seriously damage your eyes doing that. So there are lots of safe ways to do it. Even sunglasses do not help very much at all. Exactly. In fact, they might even make it worse because they open up your pupil and make it means that more of the harmful light from the sun can get into your eye. So the safe way to see it is to use the one of the easiest ways is a pinhole. That gives you a very small image. So if you have a pinhole camera effect and you have a sort of box behind it, you can see a tiny, tiny sun. It might be difficult to see that much this time because the eclipse isn't super deep. There is another method you can use where you take something like a makeup mirror or a shaving mirror and you put a little bit of a bit of paper on it with a tiny, tiny hole in it, and you can reflect the sun's image onto a wall inside your house. And if you've got a few meters distance, you might actually then be able to see the bite out of the sun that way. You can also take something like a pair of binoculars and project it. I must stress, do not look through the binoculars. Do not look through the binoculars or telescope or anything like that. But you point it at the sun and then you have a bit of card behind it and you can see the bright, you focus it, you see a nice bright image of the sun there as well. And then if you're lucky enough, and I think you'll know if you have these, but some people will have safe solar filters for telescopes, but only buy them from a really reputable supplier. If you don't have them at the moment, you know, don't try and knock anything up with foil because it isn't going to work. It has to be made of a very specialized material. And we will put a guide to all of this on our website from about next week, from early June. So we'll have all that information up on how to view it safely. But yeah, it's great. I'm looking forward to it. You know, this is the beautiful summer event. It's really well placed for the UK, and I hope lots of people get to enjoy it. Of course, we won't be able to run public events at the moment, but it should be quite accessible. Even if you have something like a pair of binoculars sitting at home, that's going to give you quite a nice view.
I think that is it for this month. Next time, we're going to be talking trash. It's all about space junk.
And we want to say a huge thank you. This month, we reached 100,000 listens. We're generally so grateful. Thank you so much. Just the idea that there's that many of you out there listening to the podcast each month is great. If you'd like to support the podcast even further, we are looking for some sponsorships to help keep the series running. If you have a business that would like to sponsor an episode or more, then please email podcast@ras.ac.uk with the subject sponsorship.
But equally, leaving a 5-star review is also really, really helpful. And we really appreciate it.
Just fueling those algorithms that rule our entire lives.
Until then, though, happy stargazing.